Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and today I welcome to the show Kenneth Cloak, who is a mediator, arbitrator, coach, consultant, and a trainer who specializes in communication, collaborative negotiation, dialogue, resolving disputes, and designing preventative conflict resolution systems. Now, he has done conflict resolution in over 20 countries, has published 15 books on conflict resolution, and was the founder and first president of Mediators Beyond Borders. What drives Ken's work is a deep belief that together we can create a global community in which conflicts become sources of learning, evolution, transcendence, and celebration. Excuse me. And in this episode of Your Partner in Success Radio, we dive into how to address and resolve conflicts in relationships, families, workplaces, and organizations. And there's no better time than now to have that discussion. Kenneth, good morning. Welcome to the show. And I apologize for my voice.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, this is a good time to have this conversation. As a rule, I make it a point to keep my podcast episodes as evergreen as they can be, because my goal is always to share you, the guest, with my audience for years to come. You know, it's not just a one and done. It's not about your event or your book or whatever's going on. It has to be really great conversations that people can listen to for a long, long time. That being said, we're not going to be able to avoid what's going on in the world right now. It's global. And, of course, I'm talking about the pandemic and COVID-19. Mm-hmm. And, of course, when you go look at social media or you even talk with your neighbors or friends, either people in my life are getting along pretty well, thank goodness, or I'm reading about just ridiculous things that are happening, such as people glaring at you if you're not wearing a mask. It's like, really? You don't want to do that. So there's a lot of weird things that are going on right now. And I think this is a great time to talk about how we can just kind of calm down and actually help one another. So I'm going to turn the microphone over to you. Before we get started, though, is there anything else about you that you want my audience to know?
No, I think you covered the basis.
Okay, terrific. Well, let's talk about how we can actually avoid conflicts, resolve conflicts. Just, I'm going to have to say it, just stop being an ass sometimes. Mm-hmm. There's an awful lot of that that's going on. So what do you think?
Well, in conflict resolution, we have a slightly different approach to it, which is not to avoid conflicts, but to realize that conflict is actually a way of telling you that whatever it is that you are doing isn't working. And therefore, it's also a way of pointing out to you how you might do something different that could work. So the object is to see that conflict has two components. One component is the destructive component of how we behave towards one another, our anger, our hostility, our willingness to humiliate each other, to treat each other disrespectfully, tension, to not listen, all of those things. But the other part, the part that's hidden, is the creative possibilities of conflict, the generative possibilities. So we can say, for example, that conflict takes place anytime there are two or more truths. And also when one of those truths or both of them believe that they're the only one. So one approach to conflict resolution is to just recognize that there is more truth than just the one that I know. And if I could find a way of learning from that other truth, I would become a better human being as a result. A second possible definition of conflict is that it is simply a lack of skill at being able to handle someone else's behavior. And what that means is that I could learn those skills. I could become more skillful. Another definition of conflict is that it is the sound made by the cracks in a system, a family system, a couple that has a relational system, an organizational system like at work, even a social, economic, or political system. And so conflict is a representation, just the sound made by the cracks in that system. And what that tells us is that we can figure out from the conflicts where the cracks are and figure out better ways of organizing that system. So there are multiple definitions like these, and the goal of it is turn away from the destructive approaches that we have to conflict, the destructive attitudes and experiences that we have with it, and to realize that something really important is going on here. If your conflicts are just one-off and you just have it one conflict and you never have that conflict again, there's not too much to worry about. But if you're having the same conflicts over and over again, as couples do, as families do, particularly now with the pandemic when people are in isolation, then what happens is that we can turn against each other and see the other one as the obstacle, you know, the problem, etc. But the truth is that conflict is a relationship between two people. And that relationship usually consists of one person doing something that causes the other one to do something that causes the first one to do what they did. And it turns in a circle. And so what mediators do and what conflict resolvers do is they figure out where the center of that circle is. What are the places where people turn against each other slip into attitudes and behaviors and emotions that then can actually become quite dangerous.
And I'm wondering, you know, as I'm listening to you talk about this, do we need to be more aware? And this is a silly question, I already know the answer, but I have to ask it. Do we need to be more aware now of conflicts instead of just sticking our nose out there and go, oh, you can't talk to me like
sure.
that, or I'm not going to wear a mask, or blah, 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 blah. It seems to me that this
yeah.
is a very good time to be a lot more introspective and a little bit kinder and say, you know what, whatever it is that person is doing, unless it directly impacts me, and I can do something about it, is just none of my business.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and even better than none of my business, it's actually something that reveals to us how interconnected we are, how interdependent we are in the world. Because the truth is that most of us would not be alive right now if it were not for doctors and nurses and healthcare professionals and grocery store clerks. And people producing
farmers,
and getting it
truckers,
to market.
Yep,
truckers, all of the people who are out there, who are, you know, bringing us food, and we would not be able to live without those people doing that. So we now have an opportunity to see how important they are, and to express a little bit of gratitude and thank yous, and really. Sort of acknowledge the courage that it takes for all those people to take the risks that they do in order that we can live our lives better. And many of us are taking those risks as well. So that means that we ought to give each other a little break, cut each other a little slack, recognize that we are all facing problems, and rather than deciding that, you know, my problem is more important than your problem, what we can instead do is to try to face our problems together. And the pandemic is a global problem.
Mm-hmm. It is. It very much is. And it can be on, and we're talking about farmers and truckers. I mean, it can be honestly just as simple as not trying to overtake a farm truck. I live in a farming community. And coming home from the grocery the other day, I realized that there was a little bit of a bottleneck. There were three tractors in front of me on this little country road. And instead of me trying to get around them, which would normally be my, oh, God, I can't stay back here all day long, I just tootled along behind them and let them do what they needed to do. I was not about to get in their way or put any of us in danger by me trying to get in another, the other lane and head on somebody else. So sometimes it just takes a bit of, I'm not in that big of a hurry. And when I did, they turned off. I tooted and waved at all of them. They waved back. I mean, it's just a way to say thank you by not getting in their way.
Yeah, I think there are lots of little ways of doing this. There's a group of people actually who've begun doing, sort of small little acts of kindness. Like if you're lining up for a toll booth, they'll pay the toll for the person behind them. And it's just it's such a small thing, but changes somebody's attitude toward everybody else and toward themselves and towards the day. It's just a really nice thing to do. So when we are, the virus is a place of stress for each of us individually and for us as a society. And what we can do when we are faced with stress is either to separate, isolate ourselves, look out for number one and forget everybody else, or we can pull together and realize that it doesn't matter whose end of the boat is sinking. We all need to get together and pull together to make that, to bail out that boat. And that's what we're in right now.
So what are you seeing? Are you seeing that people are... I'm seeing it. I'm seeing a lot of what you're talking about. I'm seeing a lot of people just saying, we are in this together. Yeah, you're going to come across the occasional jerk. I mean, they exist. We can all be that jerk on occasion, hopefully not all the time. But I'm finding by, watching and listening on social media and doing these podcasts and, talking with people that as a rule of thumb, we seem to be getting a little bit kinder, a little bit more open. Mm-hmm. That's just my observation. I have no data to support
sure.
that. But what are you saying?
I think that's absolutely right. Here's another alternative definition of conflict. A lack of awareness of the imminence of death or sudden catastrophe. And the reason for that one is because if we really knew that we were about to die, and we all are on some level, we would have a very different attitude towards our conflicts and the people we're in conflict with if we knew that they were about to die. Or if there were about to be some earthquake or some major catastrophe. And this is a major catastrophe that we are facing. So, yes, there are all of these wonderful scenes of people singing to each other in Italy and standing out and applauding healthcare workers. Those are really heartfelt occasions, and they're quite beautiful. But we also have to pay attention to the reasons why people are behaving in other ways. And often those have to do with fear, which is translated into anger rather than being expressed as fear, which is seen as weakness. Or it may have to do with the fact that somebody has just been treated badly for most of their lives, or they've been forgotten, or they're desperate, or any number of things like this can occur. But I think that if we consistently reward those behaviors, if we participate in them ourselves, if we acknowledge and say thank you for the people who've done us those favors, that goes a long way towards resolving conflicts. And the other part of it, I think, is to learn how to communicate with each other when we have disagreements. because we will disagree about any number of different things. So we can't pretend that the disagreements don't exist, but what we can do is learn from the disagreements. And this is a place that didn't really become real for me until after years of practicing conflict resolution, and that is the realization that somebody else's idea about how things should be done is a real gift. And it doesn't mean that what we think shouldn't be included, but what it does mean is that if we can find a way of combining what they think with what we think and look for creative ways of making that combination work, we can oftentimes come up with something that's better than what we thought or they thought beforehand. And that's the way real creativity works. It's the way the best solutions occur. And that takes place at work. It takes place in the home. It takes place in our communities. But in order to do that, we have to be able to listen to someone who doesn't have the same ideas that we do. We have to be willing to thank and acknowledge them for the gift of their differences. And then we have to be able to look at those differences creatively and ask ourselves, what is true about what they are saying? Not is it true or is it false, but what's true about it? And to ask questions in order to probe what the value might be in that particular perspective, because it represents somebody's experience, somebody's real experience. And that is something that we can learn from, at least at the level of wisdom and at the level of becoming a better human being ourselves by being willing to see life as less simple and more kind of richer, with a lot more diversity and a lot more kind of interesting places in it.
Very true. Not too long ago, you know, I spend a lot of time on social media, both for myself and for my clients. And not too long ago, somebody posted something, and then she immediately on my Facebook page, and for the life of me I can't remember what it was, but she instantly followed back with, "Oh, I probably shouldn't have done that. I don't want to offend you," because I know, at least she thought, my political beliefs were different from hers, and they are very different, as it turns out. And it actually hurt my feelings that she would think so poorly of me that I would punish her in some ridiculous way, like unfollowing or unfriending or blocking, because her political differences are there. And mm-hmm. I sent her a private note and I said, "What in the world have I ever done that made you think that I would react like that? Tell me what I've done and I'll correct it, because I don't want anybody to think that I'm that bombastic or I'm that difficult to get along with." She said, "No, you're not, but so many people are, and it's just kind of a knee jerk." And I thought that was horrifying.
Yeah. Well, yes, that's absolutely right. And each of us has the ability to reverse that. I think we need to kind of think about is how every conflict that we face is an opportunity for us to look at the places where we become reactive, where we immediately become angry.
Reactive. That's it. That's what
mm-hmm.
I was looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so what we can do instead is to stop for a moment, to realize that there is an emotional trigger that has just been pulled inside of us. That trigger belongs to us. And a part of our job is to find that trigger and disarm it. Because if we don't, we just are reactive throughout our lives. And I can tell you that for the most part, those triggers come from our families of origin. That's where they originate. And so what it means is tracking it back to what your mother did, what your father did, what happened in your family, whatever experiences you might have had, not only there, but in the communities that we grew up in, with siblings, with in school, in the workplace. All of these things accumulate over time. But our fundamental job in life is to give birth to ourselves. We were given birth to by our parents. And then
that's beautiful.
We have to give birth to ourselves.
True. And, you know, one of the conflict mm-hmm. resolutions that I have noticed over and over again, because like I say I work with a lot of clients, is the money conflict. And when you said it goes back
yes.
to your parents, I went, oh, because I realized uh-huh. some time ago, and it took me some digging, where my conflict with money came from, and it came from my father's, no question about it. But I could not remember or recall what it was. And once this memory popped into my head, I went, well, dadgum, there it is. What the heck? How did I not remember this? And I sorted it out, but it stuck with me for the longest kind of time because I was taught as a very young child
yes.
that money had literally no meaning. It was just throw away. I had to
yes,
get over that
absolutely.
One pretty quick. I had to reteach
yeah,
myself.
Good for you. Good for you. I think that's part of the goal of this is to catch yourself. When you start to sort of have those responses, everybody who gets married comes into their marriage with an idea about what a wife is and what a husband is. And oftentimes that idea is just completely hidden from the other person. And yet profound impact on what happens in the course of that relationship. People aren't talking about it with each other. And so what happens is that they, continually face conflicts for another reason. Here's another definition of conflict. It's a set of false expectations about who the other person is, about what they ought to do, about, what's right for them or even judgments about those people. And so the goal of conflict resolution, very simply, is just to create a conversation about these things that allows people to say, here's what's going on for me. Here's what my history is. Here's what happened in my life, whatever it may happen to be.
Okay, so, and you got me caught up on marriage. It's something I don't like much.
Okay.
Been there, done it, not going to do it again.
Uh-huh.
But you're
uh-huh.
right. The thing is that you go into it, you have no idea what you're doing for the most part. And you're having to constantly resolve disputes, real or imagined, with the person who lives in your home. And that in some
mm-hmm.
ways is in charge of the things that you do and, how you buy furniture. And, just silly little things, but they can drive you nuts. So marriage
yes.
to me is the biggest nut to crack because you have to
mm-hmm.
learn quickly some resolution skills or you're going to fail in a lot of areas in life, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Am I right or am I wrong? I mean, to me, that just seems
totally
like it's... It's the big place. It's like the big Petri dish. Fix it or die. That's all there is
mm-hmm.
to it.
Yes. I think that part of the of what draws us into these conflicts is the fact that we pick people who have different skill sets than we do, because every marriage, every serious relationship is a kind of problem solving partnership. And we are much better at solving problems if we if we're working together with somebody who approaches them differently. So we all know that teams of people, if everybody has the same skill set, they're not as good at solving problems as if they have different skill sets. And this is why diversity is such an important thing in our world, because it's a source of strength. And creativity. And the whole history of the United States really is a history of diversity that came out of lots of different cultures coming together through immigration. We're a country, really, of people from lots and lots of different backgrounds, and that was a part of our success. And I think it's the same in every relationship. We want to have some contrast between us, because if somebody's exactly the same as we are, we kind of miss the perspective that comes from looking at ourselves from the outside, or being able to bounce our ideas off of somebody who looks at them differently. And so that part is very good. But what we have to see is the unity of diversity and the diversity that's necessary for unity. So if our attitudes towards other people are fearful, angry, dismissive, disrespectful, we're going to miss out on what they have to give us that is uniquely theirs to give, which is how they're different from us. And that requires conflict resolution skills. So in the modern world, particularly in a democracy, you require a higher order of skills. So if you're in a dictatorship, you don't require very many skills. The only skills you need are how to know, how to obey orders blindly and how to keep your mouth shut. But in a democracy, you require, at a basic level, you have to figure out who you're in favor of and who you're against, how you feel about various issues. At a deeper level, in order for that democracy to really be effective, for people to really participate, or for teams at work, or for relationships to work, we have to figure out an even higher order of skills, which are the skills of listening, the skills of being able to negotiate collaboratively for what we want and what other people want at the same time, skills in being able to participate in dialogue, and skills in conflict resolution. Those are the skills we need in order to be able to tackle global problems like the pandemic. And this is not the only pandemic that has ever existed, and it's not the only one that ever will exist. We are increasingly drawn into a world which is global, and we have to have these skills in order to get along.
I agree with you. And you know, one thing that I have noticed, I've been guilty of this myself, probably will be all of my life, is that a lot of people, no matter what their skills are, whatever their mental acuity is or their emotional IQ, asking for help seems to be a hurdle, you know, for some people. I'm the same way. It's like, oh, I can do this. I got this. Get out of my way. I'll do it myself. I think as I get a little bit older, and gosh, I hope I'm getting wiser as I go day by day and add a day to my life, that I'm finding that asking for help or asking questions is often a terrific way to, you know, get into that kind of mastermind mindset. And Napoleon Hill, I believe, kind of coined that, you know, the mastermind session. And if you're two people in a room or on a phone or like we're doing right now, we're masterminding. You know, we're two different people, vastly different ideas about everything, probably, you know, different life experiences, yet here we are. And I'm learning from you. I'm taking down notes. I'm hoping that the audience is learning from you. I know they are. So sometimes the best thing to do is, you know, not stop talking and not just kind of cross your arms across your chest and, you know, I'm not going to listen to you. We don't have the same views on anything. I'm going to ask a lot of questions. I've always done that. And I find that the more questions I ask, and then if I'm smart enough to shut up and listen to the responses, and then, and that's a toughie right there, just shut up sometimes, and then say, okay, I understand where you're going, but I'm not following on this particular point. You can have a fantastic conversation and mastermind if you'll just ask questions and then shut up for a while.
Absolutely. I think that's the way. There's a positive way of saying it. Shut up has a kind of connotation of, like, you know, punishment or something.
Right.
But to say,
well, I'm from the South. We just say no, we see it. Since we're just, hey, hush now.
Yeah, but if we say to find a place of silence in which you become more open and receptive.
Oh, okay.
So the idea is not to shut yourself down, but actually to become curious about who this other person is. And that's a very different place to be in.
See, that makes so much more sense than what I said. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sure. What conflict resolution basically consists of is a set of questions that come from a place of curiosity. So we just become curious about who the other person is. And out of that curiosity, we can ask questions that we would never otherwise think of asking. Questions like, why is that important to you? Why does that matter so much to you? What does it mean to you? Why do you care so much about this issue? Things like this. So what those do is they give us access to the part of the other person that is really most interesting. Otherwise, we might miss it. And what we want to do is not not only, you know, sort of reject and stereotype and dismiss and judge the other person. We want to do something even deeper, which is to recognize that some part of us, inside of us, expands when we find out more about who someone else actually is. There's some part of us that grows, that increases. And that's the part that I think we want to pay some attention to.
And even if you never agree with whatever point was being asked about or being made, if you never can come around to agreeing with it, but you have understanding of why this person is so passionate about whatever it is, politics. I mean, that's the big thing right now.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a better understanding of how to maybe walk around conflicts. I'm not sure if I'm saying that correctly, but you can avoid them because now you understand what it is that triggers them and what it is that makes them passionate.
Mm-hmm.
And you can choose to go for the curiosity factor rather than, oh, well, that was a bunch of hooey factor, which a lot of us do. You know, we're just like, that's garbage. I'm not listening to that. But I like to research everything. I want to know everything.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. The goal of this is, once again, it's a two-step. It is to diminish the destructive side of the conflict and to increase the constructive, creative side of it. So, for example, in connection with politics, we are now heading into an election, and things are getting very hot, and they are going to continue getting even hotter. But the method that we use in order to figure out who we're going to vote for is the method of debate and adversarial confrontation and conflict. And what happens as a result is that no matter who is elected, half the country hates them. And that's not a very smart way of figuring out who your leaders are going to be. It diminishes their capacity to lead. And what we instead need to do is to have a process that doesn't do that. And the process is there. It's called dialogue. And in dialogue, you do not have to publicly humiliate each other in order to figure out whether you agree or disagree with what the other person is saying. Instead, you're able to actually have a real disagreement. And that's constructive. So it's not that we're suppressing what we think or saying it doesn't matter or denying that, you know, our experience you know, has led us to some new understanding of what should happen or whatever it may happen to be. Instead, there's a fundamentally different attitude towards it, which is the attitude of dialogue. And the attitude of dialogue is, how can we learn from each other? How could I improve my understanding of the issues by having some understanding of how you understand the issues? And if I'm confident enough in my experiences and what I believe in, we should be able to have a conversation about it. But politics instead becomes a shouting match. So I wrote a book, the last book that I wrote, which is called Politics, Dialogue, and the Evolution of Democracy. And the subtitle of the book is How to Discuss Race, Abortion, Immigration, Gun Control, Climate Change, Same-Sex Marriage, and Other Hot Topics.
Hot
and that's really
all
what
of
it's
them.
About.
Right.
Hot buttons, every one of them. So
yep.
These are issues. They're important issues. People have different feelings about all of them. And now, can we figure out how to talk to each other about these things? And the answer is yes, of course we can. But in order to do that, what we have to do is we have to ask the right set of questions. Questions like, for example, what life experiences have you had that have led you to feel so deeply about this issue? Well, that's a very different kind of question. Or another question, what do you think we might have in common? What are some concerns that we share? What are some things that we could agree on to start with? And then let's figure out what is the basis of our disagreement, really? Is there some way in which we could think about the issue that would allow us to expand the areas of agreement? And now, if we disagree, does that mean that one of us has to be wrong? Or does it mean that there could be two or more truths here? And if there are two or more truths, could there also be two or more solutions, two or more alternative ways of approaching the problem? Could we actually do a pilot project and figure out, based on testing, which approach is going to actually work the best for the most people, or whatever it may happen to be? So those are some of the skills I think that come out of small-scale conversations that can be applied to large-scale ones.
But Ken, what you're positing here is that people are taking that set of questions that you just shared with us, that they're doing this with a level head. So I'm assuming that in order to have these conversations, you have to be not emotional. You can't just go, oh, you know, I can't do it, and start stuttering and stammering. You have to be pretty level-headed and pretty clear and concise about what you're expecting to accomplish at the end of the conversation. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, I would say I'd say it a little differently. I would say that you have to be that the person who is leading the conversation, who's designing it, has to come to it from a place that understands those emotions and that is in a place of balance inside themselves with regard to those emotions, because it'll be very difficult for you to find a way for people to talk if you can't find that balance inside yourself. But
good point.
I've facilitated dialogues between Israelis and Palestinians, between Azerbaijanis and Armenians, between Russians and Ukrainians, Sandinistas and Contras, you know, all kinds of conversations between people who are enemies of each other. I've even facilitated conversations of people who have shot at each other. I'm working right now with a group, for example, in the Middle East, which is called Combatants for Peace, and it consists of former soldiers for the Israeli Defense Force, Hamas, Fatah, Islamic Jihad, etc. And these are people who are shooting at each other, people who have imprisoned and tortured each other. And they have come together to say, this does not work. We have to find another way. And through techniques like nonviolent communication, mediation, dialogue, appreciative inquiry, a whole series of different techniques, they are able to actually talk together, work together. And they just had a memorial service in Israel and the Palestinian territories online together, Israelis and Palestinians talking together and having a memorial for the people who have died. It's a very moving event. But if they can do it, we can do it too.
You know, I'm a history buff. I've always loved history. Mm-hmm. And thank you for sharing that, this amazing story. But it led me to this kind of random thought, which is the beginning of time before even recorded history. As far as we can tell, men have always slaughtered men. Why?
Mm-hmm.
I do not understand how we can be such animals. I don't get it.
There are a couple of things that are a part of this. And yes, it is shocking how unbelievably brutal we have been toward one another. The numbers of just the massive numbers of people who've been killed in wars that were pointless, where somebody is trying to gain some temporary advantage over somebody else. And if you watch these things carefully, you can really see how they begin. And they begin with the dehumanization of the other, with a fear of people who are different, with an effort to, you know, sort of maximize what is best for us. And that means even taking life away from the people who stand in our way. But we have, I think, to figure out a couple of things. One is how this works inside the brain. What is it? What are the places inside the brain that are responsible for this? And what are some of the ways of shifting those neurophysiological patterns in our brains? And it turns out that there are a number of ways of doing this. And one of those is the sort of thing that we've been talking about, which is acts of kindness towards one another, producing something that is called oxytocin, which is responsible for social bonding. And oxytocin reduces adrenaline, which is responsible for a lot of the violence that we were talking about. But we have a long way to go figuring this out. But one of the curious parts of the pandemic is, for example, that it has led to a ceasefire between Saudi Arabia and Yemen, and the Houthi rebels in Yemen. It's led to a ceasefire in Sudan. And there are negotiations taking place and mediations going on right now to create a similar ceasefire in many countries around the world, including Libya and various other places. And what the reason for this is because people are dying from the pandemic. And this doesn't seem to make any sense because people are dying from war, too. So why couldn't we stop the war before the pandemic? But there's something about the pandemic that feels human because we're all none of us want to get sick. And out of illness, we're able to recognize another person as human and pull back somehow from shooting them. To me, this is a kind of positive sign that we are somehow able to get to a place where we can recognize the humanity in each other, but it takes work and it takes skill.
See, none of that really makes sense to me that it takes a pandemic to recognize humanity. I mean, if you're shooting people, if you're digging mass graves, if you're poisoning each other with Kool-Aid or whatever the heck it is that you're up to, you weren't human to start with, I don't think. What am I missing?
No, I think that here's kind of how it works. It begins with our injury. And so someone has hurt us. And what we then do is to say, I am a decent person. I don't deserve to be hurt. Why would someone want to hurt me? Well, they must have intended to hurt me. They must hate me. Therefore, I need to not only protect myself, I need to counterattack against them because they have shown that they really don't like me. They hate me. They hate what I stand for. They hate my religion. They hate my politics, whatever it may happen to be. And what I discover is that once I have created a stereotype of them as this, you know, sort of evil-seeking group of people or whatever it may happen to be, then it becomes much easier for me to dismantle my own empathy and compassion for them. And after I've done that, that's the step that is needed, is to say, I don't have to feel empathy for this person or compassion for this person because they are less than human. I have put them into a category which is not human. And so I can treat them like a piece of dirt or something of that sort. And what you discover is that a lot of the images that are created of people who we hate over history are images that induce a sense of disgust, a sense
That's
of
true.
Fear.
Yeah, that is
mm-hmm.
true.
And it's that sense of disgust and that sense of fear. My hope is that because a lot of this does come from men, is that increasing the numbers of women in positions of political leadership will have some impact on this because women give birth to both men and women. And as through the process of giving birth and nurturing and raising children, you learn a certain number of conflict resolution skills automatically. I think also that people who have been treated as minorities, people who have been stereotyped themselves, have much stronger empathy and compassion than people who haven't. So if you ask what is the empathy of the master as opposed to the empathy of the slave is going to be much more empathetic. If you ask who understands the other better, the slave will understand the master way better than the master will understand the slave. Why? Because understanding the slave would mean giving up your property investment in someone else's slavery. So
now, can
there's a
we flip,
good financial reason. Hmm?
And I'm glad you said financial because that's where I was going. Can we flip that analogy, if you will, to business? You know, business is changing. Obviously, it has to. And that's probably not going to be a terrible thing. You know, not everybody wants to live in a cubicle or spend 2 hours on the highway trying to get to work and 2 hours back. I mean, some of these things are just ridiculous, in my opinion. But I'm wondering, because of that analogy, how this is going to really impact down the road. And we don't know. We can only, it's conjecture at this point. Will bosses, leaders are different from bosses, I think, but companies, corporations, solopreneurs, entrepreneurs, are they going to spend a lot more time getting to know the people that work with them, that work for them, who create their money, create their wealth, create whatever it is that their business is, you know, in the business of creating? Do you think that is going to change as a result of this, or will we have to get more one-on-one with the people that build us, you know, that build our companies, that build our businesses?
Well, yes. Here's, I think the difficulty is that there are a number of things that we have learned from the pandemic and a number of things that we have not learned. So we have or not learned sufficiently or everywhere. So we have learned that we're all facing death, and therefore we are one, and we are connected by this crisis and undivided as human beings. But we've also learned that we're separated physically by 6 feet, but also by race and gender and mostly age, and wealth and occupation, political beliefs, physical well-being, and therefore we are divided. So we haven't learned how to turn our differences into deeper and more powerful expressions of empathy and compassion. We haven't learned yet how to hang on to the lessons that we have learned that are positive coming out of this pandemic, and how to redesign our workplaces, as you're suggesting, in ways that are more humane. And the truth is, yeah, there are a lot of advantages to not to people working from home. And there are disadvantages as well. So what are the advantages? What are the disadvantages? How do we put these two things together and create something that is better? The more difficult problem is that we are facing increasingly a world in which robotics is going to be replacing human jobs. And this is just the way things are moving. Technology is replacing a lot of jobs, and particularly high-paying jobs, or ones that used to be high-paying. And so what we have to figure out how to do is how to design and create the kind of society we want to live in, all of us together. And of course, using people who are, have knowledge and experience, but also designing those in ways that acknowledge our interdependency. So it's not just the driving to work. We've also learned that if you look around the world, it used to be that in Delhi, you couldn't even see a block away because of pollution. And now you can see the mountains off in the distance. And you see in Venice, Italy, that there are dolphins returning. And the water has cleared and you can see the fish. Whales have returned to Wellington Harbor. And we're able to also kind of enjoy some of the break in all of that rushing around that hasn't necessarily been good for us, but has been a source of stress as well. We've learned the value of family and of friendship and of relationships and how important it is to help one another. And we have to figure out how to hold on to those lessons and not return to a kind of addiction to activity and to growth and to making money, but to figure out ways in which we can all survive better. They're doing this now in some places with universal guaranteed income or universal basic income, where people are actually paid a certain sum of money out of everybody's taxes. You receive a couple thousand dollars a month, enough for basic, expenses. And it's turned out that that's actually been a very positive experience in the studies that have been done of them. So that, I'm not saying that that's necessarily the right way to go, but that's an idea. So I think that what we have to do is we have to seriously honor the people who have died and seriously honor the people who have helped us live through this pandemic by committing that their sacrifices have not been in vain, and dedicating our energies and our intentions and our knowledge and our skills to not just coming back, but being better, coming back better than we were before.
Well said. What I have noticed, and this is an odd observation for me, and I keep kind of poking at it. When you're a kid, a tooth falls out, and you keep poking at that socket going, what happened? Where is it? I am an introvert. I have been all of my life. I thought I was a loner when I was a kid, then I discovered I was actually an introvert, and that's the way I'm happiest. So I work from home. I rarely leave my home unless I just have to or if I want to. I've designed a life that suits me perfectly. But given all of this that's going on, I have been a lot more open to picking up the phone and calling friends or calling colleagues. I never used to do that. I'm a very busy person, darn it. You know, email is good. You know, just send me an email. I'll respond. You know, it's all about efficiency. Now, yesterday, I've launched a website and had two terrific conversations with two female friends who, the one's in California, one's in Texas, I'm in Louisiana. We're colleagues. We're in some ways we're business partners. They're fantastic brains, both of them. We don't talk enough. And now we're wondering why we don't actually talk enough. We can, you know, instant messaging. Here's this. Here's Facebook. We're always in touch. We don't actually pick up the phone. I don't actually pick up the phone and say, hey, you got a moment? You want to chat? And I've actually had a craving, oddly enough, for me, because this is not who I have been, to pick up the phone and say, Tammy, Cindy, what's going on? You know, what are we up to? And it's amazing how much calmer I am after I've had a midnight conversation. Last night I was up till midnight talking with one of these gals, and it's astonishing how much we connect better now. And this is not who I was 2 months ago. I mean, I'd never disappear on my clients or friends, but I'm not a talky chatty person. I'm just not. But now I'm more willing.
I think that some part of it has to do with how many contacts it is possible for us to maintain in the world. And if there are too many of them, they begin to degrade. But
true.
If there are just a few, and the few are really good, that really feeds us. So I think a part
good
of it
point.
Is...
Good point. I hadn't worked that out. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, so that's a piece of it that's important, is to see, you know, to have those connections and have those connections be useful and valuable and not mandatory or exhausting or stressful. And this is where conflict resolution comes in as well. It's a way of turning conversations in a direction that is mutually satisfying. Sometimes in order to do that, sometimes in order to do that, you have to go into the problem deeper. But if you can do that in a way that recognizes that this is just a problem that needs to be overcome, it's not something to blame someone else for. It's not something to blame yourself for. It's not about blame. It's about figuring out how do we fix it? How do we make it better?
I was going to say, we've got just a couple of minutes, but finish your thought and then I'll ask you where people can find you on the internet.
Sure. Well, I think the big thing is to recognize that in most of our conflicts, we are creating a difference between us and them. There's us and there's them, there's me and there's you. But the real wisdom, I think, of this process is there is no them. There's just us. And that's what the pandemic points out to us. There's just us. And if we're looking for people to blame, so that's the basic idea, I think.
Yeah. And something you said earlier, you know, we are kind of trained, I think, as young children to dislike other people, to dislike cultures, to hate other people. I'll be very frank with you. I don't have the time or the energy to hate anybody. It is not worth my time to go to the trouble to locate you and hate you. I may ignore the heck out of you deliberately, but I'm not going to even be bothered to hate you. I just, that doesn't make any sense to me.
No, it's been described as drinking poison and waiting for the other person to die.
Precisely. Exactly right.
Because, what we don't realize is that hatred is a vibration that exists inside of us.
I have noticed that all of my life. You can tell when somebody is just ugly inside. You walk on the other side of the road. Get away from them. Ken,
mm-hmm.
we are out of time. This has been a fascinating conversation. It's been wonderful speaking with you. Where can people find you on the internet before I let you go?
Thank you, Denise. This has really been wonderful. I've enjoyed it too. And probably the easiest way is my website, which is www.kencloke.com.
Terrific. Well, listen, before we say goodbye, I would like to remind our audience to be sure to look for us on iTunes and honestly anywhere else you consume your business podcasts. Just look for Your Partner in Success Radio and take us along on your success journey. Ken, again, thank you so much.
My total pleasure.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.